Hello, this is Yarrow, and welcome to Vested Capital, episode number 35, featuring my guest, Yoav Vilner, the CEO and co-founder of Walnut.io, a no-code product demo platform. And their company recently went through a Series B $35 million raise, which was actually very recent to their Series A. I think it was 3 months apart. So they're growing fast, raising money fast. They may even raise another round by the time you're listening to this podcast. They are really doing things quickly, rapid growth. And that's why I'm really happy to share this interview with Yoav, because we can hear the origin story. So how did they come up with the idea? How did they launch the MVP, get their first customers, and now how they're growing through this rapid growth stage. In particular, this interview was compelling to me for two reasons. First of all, the usual advice, which, you know, it's common, but I like hearing it again and again from founders. And Yoav certainly repeated this statement that for coming up with what to build for the next phase of his platform, and even at the start, really, they went to customers. They always go back to customers to find out what customers need and then build those features. They don't build what they think they need. They don't build what the team would like to build. It's all about what the customer wants, learning about that, you know, getting people on a waiting list at the beginning because they liked what they heard, they liked the demo, and then, you know, rolling it out. So common advice, but important advice, advice I'm personally taking for my own software that I'm building behind the scenes right now. And secondly, this is, I think, a little more unusual, certainly not common. As Yoav explains, their company is in some ways creating an entire new category for, I'm not sure how to explain this, but an entire new category that all companies basically go through, which is the product demo process. So product demos, if you've ever been, especially in B2B, enterprise sales, is a huge part of the sales process. You have to show your potential customer what your platform can do. And in the past, that's been a cumbersome process because you have to rely on potentially the back end of an MVP that might not be stable, certainly isn't bug free. And here you are trying to do a demonstration and make a good impression with a tool that should work. And of course, you know, you might be a startup, so it might not work yet. And that's what Walnut helps you do. It's a cloud-based demonstration tool where you can essentially take whatever the demo is that you need to do for a particular client, which is also amazing. It's tailored from client to client, so you can be very specific and create a version of that demo within the Walnut platform on the Walnut cloud, and then go and do your presentation carefully, knowing that you've got a tailored presentation on a stable platform, a stable version of your tool. And that, as it turns out, is not something that really existed before and is certainly creating a new category. So this is also an interesting story to hear from a founder who's come up with something that is blazing a trail in a new category that, you know, competition is no doubt rising, but they're trying to lead and stay the leader in this space. So they're having to build fast. They're pushing hard with marketing. They're getting a lot of press organically. They're getting a lot of word of mouth organically, but they're really putting the pedal down on all cylinders for both paid and organic, and just, you know, press to keep the growth going and make sure they cement that leadership. And as Yoav said, I love when he said this towards the end of the interview, he wants and sees a future where whenever an employee joins a company and they're given their login for common tools, like here's your Salesforce login, you know, here's your other software login, he wants Walnut to be one of those things where it's just the default, here's your Walnut login. If you're in sales and marketing, by default, you're getting a Walnut login because you're going to be doing product demos with it. Okay, that's enough of a pitch for Walnut. The interview is great. You'll hear a lot about Yoav's background first, but then we dive into a lot about Walnut and that startup story. I hope you enjoy it. Let's begin. All right, Yoav, thank you so much for joining me today. I am so interested in hearing the Walnut story. I was actually diving into your website, just trying to get my head around exactly what Walnut does. So before I talk about your personal background, could you just give us an overview of what Walnut is and how a startup founder would actually use it?
Sure. We generally do something very simple that sparked the whole revolution in B2B sales. We allow tech companies to showcase their product, demonstrate their product in a very, very efficient and a very prospect-friendly way, not being reliant on anyone from R&D or product or design to help you with creating the demos and analyze the process also later on.
Okay, so I want to dive into the creation of that idea. But before I do that, I'd love to know a bit more about your personal background. So born and raised in Tel Aviv, Israel, is that correct?
Right,
Okay. You know, a bit of a cliche, but Israel's known for a lot of entrepreneurs. So normally when I ask, say, an American about their background, chances are their parents are not entrepreneurs and they didn't have entrepreneurs around them. Is that not the case, being born and raised in Israel? Both your parents had their own business at some point and you were surrounded by family members who are entrepreneurs?
They were actually not entrepreneurs at all. There were very few of entrepreneurs in that generation. Like for Tel Aviv, which is a massive startup hub today, as everyone knows, I think around 20 years ago is when tech started being dominant. And then 10 years ago is when I think the major explosion happened, when all the SaaS companies came to life. But very few of us have actual entrepreneurs as parents. That's from at least from what I've met in my life.
Okay. So your own upbringing, do you remember any examples around you of anyone doing their own business?
Probably stuff not in tech. I knew very few people that actually build businesses in technology when I was growing up.
Okay. So it's more like they would have owned a corner store or a clothing store or something like that, not in tech. Okay.
Right.
So in terms of your upbringing then, did you have goals to just go to university, doctor, lawyer, any of those typical fields, or were you very much interested in technology from the beginning?
So I had a very unusual turn of events. I was not in the regular course of being a tech person. I was like, when I was in high school and afterwards, and just before the army service, I was studying acting and I was playing guitars and I was like doing music and I was writing things and I was very artistic. And, you know, life events kept happening and I made a U-turn and then I joined the tech industry kind of out of nowhere when I was about 21.
Okay. Out of nowhere. What do you mean by that?
So I was starting to notice. I knew very little about everything. It was a time where startups that raised like it wasn't even 1 million seed. It was like 300K seed rounds, if we're talking like 12, 13 years ago. And I noticed that those startups had nothing to do with the seed rounds they've raised in terms of like growth and marketing, because there were no talents and there were no agencies and there was barely any freelancers. No one really knew how to do marketing and growth for startups. It was much before tech marketing, growth hacking, all that was a dominant phrase. And then me and a friend who knew a little bit more about marketing than I did, we just started reaching out to a couple of those startups that we saw have raised the impressive 300, 400Ks seed rounds. And we told them, you know, maybe we can do all of your marketing efforts as freelancers. And they didn't really have a choice, because no one else knew how to do that. We barely knew how to do that, but it was more than the actual founders. And that turned into the biggest company and one of the first companies in the world to do marketing for startups. So we eventually had around 600 customers. We had a couple of dozens of employees and we had offices in a couple of different countries.
So when you say marketing, was it, you know, pay-per-click, inbound, outbound? What was the sort of everything above, branding?
Yeah, it was everything a tech company would need that the major ad agencies could not deliver them in proper budget. So yeah, everything that you said and the guerrilla marketing and, you know, implementing HubSpot, content marketing in very, very modern ways, anything that's growth, you know, Reddit, a lot of stuff that were kind of unusual because everything was very standout and boring marketing back then. And we kind of broke that theory.
Okay. So sounds like you were very early, especially for Tel Aviv in that space. Did that turn into a company that you want to raise funding for? Or what's the story there? Was it bootstrapped and then you eventually sold the company, or how did it go?
Yeah, it was bootstrapped. It was very successful. We were everywhere. We had a little gnome as a logo. And we had a huge wall with a graffiti spray of that gnome, and people from the industry were coming and they did like a selfie with it. And it was like really the cool kids around. But more than that, we actually built a whole category of tech marketing, because it was really, there was not a lot of alternative back then. And startup founders were kind of going crazy for the fact that now they can leverage someone to actually grow and activate a lot of stuff they couldn't before. And I lived in London, I lived in Manhattan, we had all those offices, it was a lot of fun. But after 6 or 7 years of being the CEO, I came back to Tel Aviv and I moved on to my next ventures.
Okay, what's the reason behind the change? You just wanted something different?
Yeah, I felt in a place where everyone is telling you how cool and amazing everything that you do is, but if you do it right, then you see other companies grow to incredible heights. So if you're good at what you do, you're one of your customers would raise $200, $300 million and become a mega unicorn company. And all you had, you had a huge impact on it, but all you got in return with was just a couple of months worth of helping them out. And it really felt like a glass ceiling, because if you can do all this stuff, why not do them for your own venture? That was kind of the thought that I had.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I remember my early days, I had a friend who had a marketing firm. I was born in Australia, and I remember him running these pay-per-click campaigns, and the clients would become large companies. And like you said, you only get the agency fee from it. So for you to exit the company, was that clean and easy? You just, you know, sell your shares, or do you just exit but remain an owner? How does that happen?
Yeah, I'm no longer one of the owners. And I had a partner, and he brought on another partner. Eventually, I sold my shares and felt that this journey was
complete,
was coming to an end.
Okay. So you obviously wanted to start a new project. You have marketing skills, which is fantastic for another project. But what were you thinking for the next business? Were you going to get into more software? I don't know if you're an engineer yourself. Do you have any programming SaaS skills, or you're more, that's a no by the look of your face there. So tell me about the next project and how it got started.
I'm definitely a man of a couple of great qualities, but coding was not one of them. Mm-hmm. And it's not now also when I'm the CEO of a successful SaaS company, but we can talk about that.
Yeah.
So when I was finishing my journey as the CEO of that company, I was already very much involved with the entire tech scene, anywhere from, you know, the top investors to CEOs to CTOs to developers to anything you can imagine. I was in a very convenient place of like building a huge network, helping everyone out, connecting people, making them grow like crazy, and making a lot of noise and mentoring in accelerators and writing columns for CNBC and Forbes and other magazines about all that craziness. But when I finished my time there, I was ready to build out a tech company of my own. And then the next couple of months were kind of a, you know, CTO dating, founder dating, ideation, asking investors what's like the hot topics that they are aware of right now, which is kind of the dumbest questions you can ask, because no one really knows what you should build besides yourself. And then when I was about to raise a seed round for something great that I had with a CTO, but I also came across an opportunity to join as a founding member, not as a CEO, but as a founding CMO, to a startup designed to save kids from bullies on social media, with alongside a CEO that is a very high figure, and he had a huge exit in the past. He's a judge on the Israeli Shark Tank. He's angel invested in like 200 companies. And we know each other from like, we both came from the same, we call it kibbutz in Israel, which I never know how to explain to other people because it's not a thing in other places. But it's anywhere from a small town to a village, some sort. And anyway, we were both from there originally. And I joined as a founding CMO, and the startup had a great vision. But after about a year and a half, I realized that building Walnut was the passion, and that was the thing that I was moving on to.
Okay. And that's quite different from a startup that's helping children with bullying. So while you're spending the year and a half in that company with this very famous CEO, are you looking for other business ideas and Walnut comes your way? Or is it more like a flash in the pan? You sort of think, you know, this is a need, or is there a specific experience you have? I'm assuming with something to do with product demos that led to the idea.
So yeah, it was an idea that had a lot of different variations and evolution throughout a long period of time. Because when I had that marketing company, I saw for a couple of hundred of major tech companies, I saw what happened when they spent millions of dollars on getting people to see what they're doing in all kinds of different, you know, campaigns and stuff. And then I saw what happened to conversion rates eventually when someone had to actually see what the product is doing. You know, it's all part of the same funnel. And it was very clear to see early on that things always broke. I didn't have a solution to it. It seemed like a given and a reality that people had to face with. You spend a lot of money and the conversion rates will be terrible. I carried that thought, and alongside my co-founder, we kind of realized that we know where this is all coming from. because he's seen the same pain points when he had a startup and he was selling to enterprise companies and eventually had an exit and he joined the enterprise company. And he was seeing that funnel from the other way. And eventually we all said, maybe, like, you know, the backbone of this whole thing, which is costing companies billions, is if salespeople could kind of create their own product demos without having to ask for favors, anyone from R&D, product design, if they just had like a, what initially for us was like a Wix-like editor where they can just customize the demos and they would not crash because it's on the cloud. So maybe the conversion rates would be much, much, much better.
Okay, so just so I understand, you're talking about conversion rates for all the marketing. So you obviously come from the marketing background, you're doing all this lead generation, and then somewhere along that sales process, things are breaking down, the conversion rate's bad. And your assumption was it's the demo process that the salesperson is doing that might be contributing to why the conversion rates are low, whether that's because, like you said, they're running it off cloud software and the demo breaks or just doesn't load well during the demo. It's not tailored, customized. So that's kind of like the original seed point for the idea. And there's the assumption there too, that that is where the breaking point is in the sales cycle as well. So I'm assuming when you have that thought, your next assumption as a marketing person is, how do I test and validate whether, you know, you need a demo of your demo, so to speak. So what happened next?
Right. So what happened next is, and this is the main tip I've ever given in my life to founders was, like, always make sure that you're solving a major, major pain point. Otherwise, your journey is going to look bad. You have to solve something really meaningful for people to actually want to pay for it. And so we went on and we spoke to about a couple of dozens of VP of sales. I think it was like 70 from tech companies across the world. They were not our friends and they were not our family. And we asked them, what's like the biggest pain points for you guys in your department to actually convert better from the demos? And we noticed that we didn't even tell them about the solution yet. That was also a tactic that I had of, we didn't tell them this is a product we're doing. What do you think? Because everyone will tell you it looks amazing, but they wouldn't pay for it, right? Mm-hmm. We wanted to hear from them. What are the pain points? And we kept hearing, you know, there's tons of friction between my sales team and the R&D and the sales teams and product and the sales team and design. And every time they go on a demo call, it breaks or it crashes or it freezes or someone touched production or backend before the call and everything broke and everything crashed. Or we are just sending access to our actual live product, but it doesn't make sense that so many different prospects will see the exact same experience of the product because it's not customized. And when you hear that over and over again, you're realizing that maybe the initial idea you had makes sense. And then when we show them that MVP that we were working on, that's when a waiting list started to form and it completely exploded from there. When we just started, we had about 700 salespeople in our wait list.
Wow. Okay. So I've got several questions here. You mentioned Walnut is like Wix. So like what you see is what you get editor for making demos. So correct me if I'm wrong here. And I haven't done a demo of Walnut itself yet, but I'm assuming I would, you know, learn this by doing that. But just to clarify, I set up my Walnut account. I have my software that I want to do the demo. I use Walnut to essentially capture screenshots and customize those screenshots to the individual that I would be doing the demo for. And then I can present to them a very tailored version of what my software is that's not running on like a production server. So there's no risk of it crashing. It's kind of like a locked environment. So it's stable, it's customized. I can show the screens that I need to show. I was curious though, and correct me if I'm right about all of that, does it get more interactive than that? Like, is not just editable, but it's, you know, it functions as a working demo in terms of I could still use the software? Explain how that works.
Right. So you were almost totally right, besides the fact it's not really screenshots. We use our technology to kind of take anything from your front end, anything that's visual, JavaScript, you know, videos, graphs, charts, menus, everything. And we replicate it in our cloud environment as a new instance of your product, which you can customize and drag and drop. We ignore anything that's backend because that's not interesting and we're not connected to your production at all. Okay. So it's not really screenshots. It's more like choosing the main aspects of your product. And you can just kind of showcase a fake, you know, like you would pretend to be running a demo on your real product, we will just replicate all that into Walnut. Like, you don't have to go one by one. And then, yeah, you drag and drop your way into making it perfectly tailored to specifics of your prospects and their use cases and what they need. You can collaborate with your other salespeople and tell them, this template for a demo, which we refer to as a storyline, this template for a demo worked best for a cyber client, and that one worked for a gaming client, and etc. Eventually, what's most interesting is that if you have insights and analytics across all of that process and you plug it into your CRM, so you close a huge loop that was really a shot in the dark up until when Walnut launched.
Okay, interesting. How did you come up with that structure, especially given you're not an engineer? I'm not an engineer too. I would have been like, how much can we do of this idea? I'd be straight away thinking like screenshots for sure, downloading a front end, making it stable and editable in our own cloud. I'm like, oh, I'm not sure how much of that is possible. So were you the man behind that?
You have people on your founding team that are better than you in all kinds of stuff. And today when we're a growth stage company, for instance, I have a VP of finance. I'm not a finance person, right? You bring people that complement your skill set. And I was doing this with a CTO. We had a couple of super, super impressive developers as founding members, and we built it out all from scratch.
Okay. Where did you meet all these people? Was it more CTO dating like you did previously?
No. So specifically, my CTO, we were kind of already belonging to a couple of groups with mutual friends for a couple of years. We haven't built companies together in the past, but I knew of his, you know, previous successes. He knew of mine. We had a lot of passion to solve this thing, and it was a very fast connection in making Walnut what it is.
Okay. So take us forward then. You have a large waiting list for something that you've validated, at least through conversation, that people want. You have the concept that you want to get, I'm assuming, done to like an MVP, so you can get these people from the waiting list onto the MVP. How did all that roll out?
So at that point, when we had 700 people on a wait list, we felt confident of trying to raise our first round, seed round. It was during COVID 2020, VCs were shrinking, LPs were not sending money, startups were not raising funds, valuations shrinked. And people told us, you must be mad if you're raising seed round right now. The terms will be bad. No one will believe in it, blah, blah, blah. I have to tell you that crisis times, and it's kind of relevant what's going on right now, are incredible times to be launching a new startup. If you're a good team with a good idea, right? Otherwise, it's going to suck. But it can be a good time to launch a startup like it was for Walnut. We started with raising 2.5 million seed round, which was led by a fund called NFX from the Valley, the CEO of Wix, Joe Montana's fund, which is called Liquid 2, and a few more angel investors. With that seed round in place, we brought on a couple of more team members and we just launched the product.
Tell me about a seed round here. You're the CEO, so you're the face who's knocking on all the doors and having all the meetings. And correct me if I'm wrong, you talked about raising previously with your other projects, but you never did, right? You never reached that point because you joined the other company instead. So this was your first experience of actually taking money. What was it like? I mean, Joe Montana, famous, you know, footballer. This sounds like that's an interesting mix there of angels and VC. So how did that all play out for you?
Right. So first of all, in the startup that was before Walnut, we raised a 15 million seed round and I was in charge for a very nice portion of that, not as the CEO, but we kind of did it everyone off their connections and abilities. And just before that, I was securing a 2 million seed round for a startup that I decided not to do because I wanted to pursue the kid saving startup. But so it wasn't my first experience, definitely the most successful one because a lot of stuff happened in our first year after that. Seed, we ended up also extending our seed round to 6 million after a couple of months. And 3 months later, we've done a Series A, and 3 months later, a Series B.
I saw that, a very quick 3 months, 3 months, 3 months. That's very unusual. Yeah. Any insights? I realize maybe the more recent raise is easier because you're showing crazy growth. I saw TechCrunch quoting 700% growth. So naturally, it's, I'm assuming, a lot easier to do that next round, but the first round especially, and maybe the extension of it to 6 million, what led to that being as successful as it was? Is it your connections, your network? Is it the idea? Usually it's the people involved. So did you have a lot of good relationships with people that believed in you?
So first of all, the founding team was just insane. Like the people joining us, you know, the first developer, the first this, the first that, they were like, our head of marketing was just finishing 8 years at Wix, where he had a senior role. Our VP of sales joined our founding team and started building out our pipeline while helping us build out the product because it's a sales guy and he knew what salespeople want. And I think the backgrounds of everyone all together made a crazy achievement for the seed funds. I think that funds recognize that me and my co-founder both, this is like our third run. And so it was not a matter of betting too early on a person. And the other thing, everyone knows it's a huge problem. And also when we were validating our idea, if you talk to a sales leader and you tell them about demos and how horrible they are, they would just, you know, they would stop you when you just begin the question. And then we say, you're totally right. Give me a solution. So, right. So it was a very easy for investors to kind of check around what we're building.
Okay. Makes sense. So you get the initial funding. How hard was it to build that first version? And did it work? Like, did your demo of your own product work well?
Yeah, it did. It didn't have a lot of functions. Like you could just take one screen off your SaaS dashboard and use it on the Walnut cloud and customize and make something out of it. That was our MVP. Of course, up until today, now we're 2 years old and it became a whole platform that does incredible things. But the MVP was not that attractive, I have to say. It was functioning, but I don't believe in putting too much effort into your MVP because if you don't meet your market and you don't get feedback fast and lots of it, it's just a waste of time.
Okay. When you presented it, what was the feedback with just the MVP? Did you take it to all 700 people on the wait list or were you a bit more selective?
We were selective because we didn't have enough money in the bank or working hands to handle hundreds of customers, obviously. So we chosen a couple of companies that are Fortune 500 companies. We chosen a couple of customers that are smaller startups across different verticals. And we wanted to check where the impact that we have is the most dominant. And we actually figured out that we're very agnostic to the size of the company because it's a cross-vertical problem. Everyone needs it. Everyone has it. And today we're working with a couple of hundreds of customers.
Okay. So the reaction was initially very positive by the sounds of things. I'm assuming, though, because it was somewhat limited at the beginning, it was more like a taste of the potential than what you are today. In terms of feature development, which is always a challenge, I think, for a startup, especially at the beginning, it's like, you know, you're resource limited. You can't build everything that you might be thinking about you want to build for the future. So you have to pick and choose what's the features you want to roll out. How did you make that decision of, you know, what do we build next with the smaller team at the start?
So every decision we've ever made around our product was because someone needed it. We never release things that someone from our team had a dream about at night, not even myself. And it's all about what the customers need. So we had a couple of design partners and they told us what they need. And if we found out there's like an average, you know, there's like a meeting point with all the different feedback that we got, then we just built it. There was one Fortune 500 company that came in and said, you know, my dashboard is like 20 years old and it's mostly built out of X, Y, and Z, things we were not supporting. And we were still like a 5-people team. And we told them we need a week. They gave us a week. They signed with us and they've been expanding with us for the past 2 years. So everything we've done was according to customers, if it met our strategy, but we've never built stuff that the market did not need.
What does the market really love? What's the main sort of, I mean, you're talking about big companies, you like agnostic, like you said. So small businesses, big businesses, what's the sort of general feedback in terms of what they really, really like about it?
A lot, actually.
Everything.
Yeah, I would say, you know, first of all, when you reduce that painful friction between sales teams and any other team, because we've all been in B2B companies, right? If you're even the best sales rep of your company and, you know, you're going on a call with Microsoft and Microsoft says, hey, if you just support, I don't know, audio or video in your product, then we will sign a $500,000 ARR deal. And then you go on, you run along all happy to the VP product or VP R&D or whatever, even CTO, and you tell them that, you're not going to get help. Nobody's going to be able to build out how to showcase that new feature that you don't yet have or that specific feature that the customer needs. Nobody's going to, you know, stop working on their pressure timelines and roadmaps and everything and help out the salesperson unless this is like the strategy of the company and then they will do it. But even then, they would not like doing it. So we just gave such empowerment. They don't need anyone. They can just edit the product to customize a specific use case. They can make the data suitable to what the prospect needs. They can make the entire experience specific to that problem. And this is why we also now just released a movement called We Are Prospects on LinkedIn, which was a big hit, and it was seen by about 5 million people organically on LinkedIn.
Wow.
We did like a video of what if buying a shirt was as painful as buying software. And we showed what happens when the buyer is getting a bad experience. And this is exactly what we're helping them solve.
Interesting. Okay, I have to look out for that video. I'm quite curious to see that. We Are Prospects. Okay, so you know, you're still a young company, you know, 2 years in terms of, and you've grown incredibly fast. You've taken on a lot of funding in very quick jumps with these rounds. And we're talking now really in a downturn in terms of, you know, the market, the inflation, even how much venture capital is being deployed. So I'd consider your story an outlier for what is typical now. It almost sounds better for a story 3 years ago when everything was really hot and there was a lot of money being deployed. So clearly, you know, your unique case going forward with Walnut, is it a case of just managing the demand now and just meeting the needs of everyone coming at you? Because correct me if I'm wrong, I don't think you're probably doing a lot of marketing yourselves right now, besides a few campaigns like the one you just talked about, that prospect ad. You've got more customers inbound than you need to go out there trying to stimulate manually. Is that fair to say?
The inbound demand that we have is never seen anything like it. Like sometimes people are pissed at us because our salespeople would send, you know, Calendly links and they would only allow you to talk to them in like 2 or 3 weeks. But it's literally just seeing thousands of inbounds each month. The thing is that we're also in a fast hyper growth mode because we've built out this whole category from scratch. A lot of smaller teams are, you know, popping every day trying to replicate it with just raising seed rounds. And we're running super, super fast. We're dominating the market. You can't really stop at just the inbound. So we also have an outbound motion and an aggressive marketing.
Okay, so this is an interesting insight. When you hit on something that people really need and you know there's a lot of demand, the competitors do start to pop up. And one of the best ways to counter that is just to be really aggressive with your own growth. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah, okay. So going forward, is this a case of just, you know, listening to what the needs are, keep adding features? Obviously, a new funding round, probably not in 3 months. I assume now you can take a little breather and, you know, grow and deploy. Is that the strategy?
Our strategy is to make our hundreds of customers, thousands of customers in the near term and scale very fast. Those very few marketing campaigns that you're referring to, you know, the audience should probably know that each one of them drives a couple of millions of organic impressions. We have this thing where, first of all, there's a huge community of ambassadors and fans right now around Walnut, which we didn't use any resource to build out. It just started forming because the market identified who was building the new landscape, and it's us, and they're appreciating it. We were like the first or second product of the day on Product Hunt like 4 times. That movement we built had a couple of millions of salespeople to watch it. We just won an award by LinkedIn, the first top performing growth company in Israel. And we get like between 30 or 40 press articles almost every month organically.
Wow.
It's all like a huge puzzle, a lot of channels are working around us. It's a very aggressive motion in our go-to-market. We don't spend a lot of money on it. It's happening because, like I said, when you just start off in your MVP, if you're solving a huge pain, the market will reward you.
Yeah, and a little bit more than that, you're solving a huge pain, and it sounds like you're in the space of marketing and sales tools. So maybe it's natural for that community to sort of coalesce around a great product and want to talk about it and share within themselves. Even the press side of things is interesting that you're getting organic. You're not sort of forcing that. So at the end of the day, you're a tech tool for making sales. It's not like a mainstream news story that, you know, you're getting press about. So I'm assuming it's marketing and sales related press, but that's still, it's impressive. Enjoy it. I have to say, that's something to be, as a founder, you dream about this, right? Being in the right spot, getting a lot of free coverage, a product people love, you know, people throwing money at you. Do you have any problems right now? Or are you just very happy?
I get asked a lot about problems. Everyone are like, everything can't be that perfect, guys. Come on, give us the gossip. It's really, there's a lot of pressure when you build out a whole category and you're like, you know, from the moment like Gartner starts writing about you and the, from the moment people tell you there's now a budget in companies called a budget for interactive demos, you're realizing you're building out a category, and it's a lot of pressure because you can never stop where you are now. Like if you're very impressive for your Series B phase, now people want to see, all right, what's it like when you're a $1 billion company? All right, what's it like when you're the next CRM? If you can't deliver that, people are going to be disappointed. It's like you don't get a moment to just stop and enjoy. You have to keep running. It's very stressful. Luckily, I do think it's one of the strongest teams that exists in B2B. And I do think that the research that LinkedIn has done to rate us first in Tel Aviv out of everyone was because the team is super strong and unique. And that gives me a lot of motivation to keep going.
Yeah, you're talking about, like, you made me think about Salesforce and HubSpot and how big they are, like absolutely huge platforms. I was actually at the HubSpot conference and it's like 30,000 people there, all marketers, all using this tool. You're talking like that's where you see Walnut going. You're creating a category and you basically want to make sure you're the platform of choice. Is this as big as a Salesforce or a HubSpot in terms of a platform in your mind in the future?
I think it's different, definitely different. I think that the partnership and collaboration and integration into the CRMs will be a huge step forward for our landscape. There's a lot of data plays that you can do around that. In terms of comparing the landscapes, you know, I don't think anyone will be the next Salesforce. I think they're just too big. And I think that's kind of overthinking it. I'm just trying to think, like, what's the best value we can actually bring every salesperson worldwide? Like when a sales rep is on their first day of the job and they get a password to their Gong and they get a password to their HubSpot and whatever, and, you know, Google or whatever, we want them to also get a password for their Walnut. Mm-hmm. And it's already happening, but we want to see it happening everywhere and all the time.
I like it. I like it. That's great. You know, you come from an interesting background with your music and your sort of creative, and then your switch to marketing and now CEO, founder. I have a couple of questions. I'm assuming you're very happy doing what you're doing now and you see yourself running this, you know, for a while. What is your day in the life like for you, and how do you get to, because I mean, you've got to be a creative person. You came from a marketing background. You came from a musician, artist background, which means you need a way to stimulate your creativity and, you know, put things out into the world. So do you get to do that in the day in the life of the CEO of Walnut right now?
That's a great question. So a couple of more things that I'm trying to do. First of all, I'm a guitarist of a startup band. So everyone is a founder. And that kind of combines all of the different worlds. So that's nice. I practice Thai boxing, which is...
What's the name of your band before you keep going so we can find you?
It's a very embarrassing name. We are not listed on YouTube even. It's like just a cover band for fun. But we're still debating between a midlife crisis and chief musical officers.
I like the second one. Okay.
Yeah. And then Thai boxing, you know, sports, running, playing stuff, playing piano, just trying to calm the craziness down sometimes.
Okay, so and then during like your day, what is a working day for you at Walnut like? What do you, early riser, late riser, in before everyone else?
I'm very early riser and I am very late to finish the day. So, you know, for good and bad, I'll probably be one of the first people in the company. So by now we're, depending on when you broadcast this, but we're about 110 people. I'm probably one of the first ones every day to go online and bug everyone and, you know, answer Slack and send emails and go over everything. But like I said, when the team is so incredible, then your meetings are fun. Like there's a lot of stress, a lot of challenges, a lot of discussions and arguments. But even days that are busy with like, you know, 12, 13 meeting packed in one day, it's still somehow fun because you're enjoying to work with the people that you work with. You're getting appreciation from the world and from the market. And so even the busiest days that I have are still really great.
Is your role, like you said, you're replying to Slacks and it sounds like you're sort of everywhere, but because you're now, you know, moving away from being the founder of a small company to 100 plus people, your role must have changed. Like, are you doing a lot more hiring and that's your kind of predominant job now is hiring, or is there an HR person who focuses on that? Like, what are you really specializing in now yourself?
So I have to be, like you said, everywhere. The management team does an amazing job at, like, you know, everyone, like supervises what they have to, and they let me know, and that's how I'm involved with everything. I also keep on talking to everyone. You know, if I can grab someone from each team every couple of weeks for just like a conversation, check what's up, then I hear a lot of interesting angles. But my VPs and team leaders and directors are all very incredible at kind of letting me. We have a lot of transparency. Also, we have like weekly syncs of the entire company, and every week, every team leader sends like a report on Slack with all of the numbers. And so there's a lot of transparency going on all the time.
Okay, that's great. I mean, maybe wrap it up here. Last question for you, Yoav. You've given a lot of, I feel, smart advice for other founders who are, especially your advice on picking a in-demand need. And you've demonstrated why that can be so beneficial despite how Walnut is just growing like crazy. And it's making everything, I won't say easy because I know it's not easy, but it's coming at you rather than you having to go out and generate demand or generate funding. You've got it inbound. So besides that core idea for the fellow founders, is there anything else you would consider absolutely critical advice if they want to follow very much in the footsteps like you know, raise a seed round, build a SaaS platform and follow that, you know, aggressive growth path, even as ambitious as what you're doing and potentially creating a category?
Yeah, I would choose the founding team and trying to bring the strongest people that I could. I would partner with investors that I think can add value, and I would check in their portfolio if they've actually invested in things that are in the same category or niche as what I'm building. I would be a founder that sells. Like, don't be afraid of going on sales calls. At first, you have to be there and you have to listen to how the market is reacting to your potential future product. You have to be a storyteller. Like, some founders are hiring full-time storytellers these days, and it's a joke, right? Like, there's a lot of smart advisors that can be freelance and help you out if you lack of it as a CEO. But I think CEOs have to know how to tell a strong story. That's what the world is expecting of them. That's what the employees are expecting of them, and investors and everyone. And just like hurry to meet your market as soon as you can.
Okay, that's great advice, Yoav. Thank you for sharing your story and also diving deep into Walnut and what's going on behind the scenes. I really appreciate that. Anything else you want to throw out at us before I hit the end button?
No, it's a great show. I hope everyone enjoyed, and that's it.
Okay, and obviously it's walnut.io if you want to actually get using the tool itself. I'm assuming, like you said, your salespeople have very small windows in their calendar for doing sales calls. But I guess whenever this goes out, you can check what the availability is and start playing with the software itself. So walnut.io, thank you, Yoav, and good luck with the future growth of the company.
Thanks.
Today's episode was brought to you by InboxDone.com, a virtual executive assistant service that specializes in managing your email and scheduling your calendar. So if you're spending large parts of your day replying to messages, going back and forth with scheduling, dealing with low-level activities that don't really move the needle for your business, then you need to delegate that task to InboxDone. They will assign you two assistants who will learn everything about you, your company, your writing style, and then step in, create a system, make things more efficient, build procedures, templates, rules, folders, all kinds of structure, take over task management, embed within your existing team, and most importantly, actually reply to your emails. So if that's something that sounds exciting to you, head to inboxdone.com and book a discovery call today. All right, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Yoav Vilner, the CEO and co-founder of walnut.io. For me, what was especially unique about this podcast was the fact that Walnut is entering or has entered a category that is old. We've need to do product demos since we first created software. It's not something new. People do product demos every day. It's a key component of selling most software, especially at the enterprise level. Yet, Yoav and his team was able to enter this space and provide a new software platform to fix pretty obvious problems, now you think about it, that were already in this demo space. It's something that I think a lot of people in sales and marketing have experienced, trying to demo something and the software crashing. I mean, I've seen movies where that's been part of the storyline, where there's been a potential big client signing up and they're meeting in a hotel lobby and they're trying to demo the software. And of course, the software won't load and they're calling back to the dev team back in another city. And, you know, that's the story. That's one of the things that Walnut exists to fix. So great idea. creating a new category. Loved hearing that story. Hope you did too. If you want more stories with other entrepreneurs, people doing successful startups, maybe they've had an exit, and also other people doing things with property, investing, crypto, that's what Vested Capital is all about. You can find all the episodes on all your favorite podcast players, Spotify, Apple, Amazon, wherever you get your downloads and stream, you can find Vested Capital. You can subscribe there. You can also search for my name, which is Yaro, Y-A-R-O, and you should be able to find Vested Capital that way. It's also on YouTube. If you're video, you can watch these episodes. Not all of them are video. A lot of the older ones are not, and I don't do every episode in video, but you can find most of them there, including today's one with Yoav Vilner. And please subscribe. Really appreciate it. And more importantly, please tell your friends and family members if this episode struck a chord with you and you think it might impact someone you know, might impact, you know, a fellow budding entrepreneur, then please share this episode with them. I'd really appreciate the spreading word of mouth about Vested Capital and helping to reach more people and helping more people. Okay, that's it for me. My name is Yaro, and I look forward to talking to you on the very next episode. Bye-bye.